So again, this is supposed to be very informal, and so you know that means you're allowed to ask questions. Oh, it's on. He said it was on. So I didn't turn it off.
Are you going to use this?
No.
Would you mind putting it on the floor?
I'll throw it on the floor. I was told I wasn't allowed to use that. You know, this is a little bit like bringing coal to Newcastle, because a lot of the experts in this field, both experimentally, the Seth Fraden visiting, and theoretically, are here. So, and I'm going to say a little bit my view of what most of work that's done by them. Okay, so here's another expert. So one of the undercurrents that's running through this program is the fact that there's a bunch of evidence on the various circumstances that objects, these are sort of macroscopic objects that are charged with the same sign, seem to attract one another, okay, under certain circumstances. And at the end of the day, and that's been a problem that's been around for about, to my knowledge, around 20 years at least. You know, I was worrying about it a little bit about 15 years ago, but at that time, hardly anybody was worrying about it, and then I gave up. So let me tell you what some of the evidence is. Could you guys hear back there? It's not interesting, so you might as well leave. And the whole thing to me is more of a problem in sociology rather than a problem in science. It's a problem where we get confused of what words mean, and that's what the problem is. I don't think it's so much a science problem, although there are science issues that we don't understand. So let me give you the first kind of problem that I know of involves in colloids. And what I mean is that if you take a beaker of water, and you put in some charged plastic beads, let's say charged particles that may be a micron size or a thousand of angstroms, little beads that are charged, and put them in water. They're all, let's say, identical particles, each one with maybe typically a few thousand ionizable groups that could ionize, usually sulfonic acid or something like that. These are, they could be glass or they could be polymers, and they ionize. So you have counter ions, let's say you have counter ions, maybe sodium or maybe protons, in solution. And the usual, these objects have been studied for a long time for various reasons. What you would expect naively is that between these objects, there's a repulsive screen Yukawa-like interaction, which is repulsive. And where kappa is some Debye screening length. And I'll be more explicit about these as we go along. And in fact, you would expect that because the charge is so high on these, as I say, thousands of charges, that you might, if the distances are right, usually the distances are comparable, you know, to the sizes of the particles, that the interactions are so strong that they would even form a crystal in water at room temperature. And they do. These are called colloidal crystals, and I say they've been known for at least 20 years. And these crystals are interesting, and people study them a lot for for various things.
Aren't they also the opals?
They're also, in fact, usually the length scale involved is in thousands of angstroms, so they have very beautiful diffraction of light, and that's the origin of of opalescent opals. Exactly. So that's exactly right. Now, what's also, everybody who works with these systems, and some of you in this room have, even I have, because it's very simple. You just buy these little particles, you put them in a glass of water. What's observed pretty much ubiquitously is that if you go to very high concentrations, and typically around 50% volume fraction, that you tend to observe what we would think as a phase separation, that all the particles go down here and you have essentially pure water up here. Okay, that's basically always observed. And usually when you observe that, and people observed that 30 years ago, or certainly over 20 years ago, was that you say this is a bad sample and you throw it away, of course. But it's always there. It's always there. And there's a lot of reasons why it might be. I mean, obviously, the suggestion is that this looks like attractive interactions, okay? And as far as I know, it's always observed, and, you know, and everybody didn't like it, so they ignored it. Not everybody. I mean, there were people who... And in fact, this kind of phenomena led to some very strange theories of electrostatic interactions, which I won't mention, okay? Because they don't deserve to be mentioned.
It's known manifestly, this is not just sedimentation, because you said it's a huge part.
Yeah, these are much, yeah, it's not gravity. I mean, the gravity effects are negligible, and all these things are, yeah, it's nothing trivial like that. And if you change the density, you can make the particle less dense and it goes up. I mean, all this is all checked. Okay, so these are particles. Think of them as thousands of angstroms, maybe with 10,000 charges. Those are the typical kind of numbers. That's one set of experiments. Another set of experiments you heard about from Bill Gelbart has to do with DNA. As he told you, and I'll repeat, DNA is a long polymer. The important thing for what I want to tell you is that it has about one charge, roughly speaking, per 1.5 angstroms along the chain. Okay. It could be 1.3 or... Huh? Well, no, it has no, basically one base pair every 3 angstroms or so. When it's in solution, so they could... these are bases, yeah. And yet, it's also known that, and these DNA is typically very long. For example, for bacteria, it's easily in the range of millimeters if you measure it along the contour. Yet these things package into, let's say, heads of viruses or in cells that are of the dimension of the order of a micron. And in fact, when you lyse something like this, when you break it open, you see these beautiful pictures of all this DNA stuff coming out here, and you wonder how the hell could all this stuff be pushed in there. What we now know, I don't know, the biologists know, is that packaging of DNA is to a large extent engendered by attractive kind of electrostatic interactions, which are mediated in the case of bacteria by small molecules that are highly charged, that are cationic, spermine or spermidine, two small molecules that are one of valence 4, one of valence 3, which allow this thing to be packaged. So that somehow these small ions, these are small, I won't draw what they are encouraging this DNA to get all packed together in some efficient way, and which is, again, we know plenty of evidence is electrostatic.
Where are the small molecules? DNA?
Well, no, you just add them in, and then they somehow complex with the DNA.
Does that happen naturally?
It happens naturally, yeah, if you allow these. And it also happens in vitro, if you want to.
So what does the compact DNA look like in vitro?
I don't know, and I don't care at this point. Okay. I don't know.
But these molecules are DNA-dependent. Yeah. I mean, for any organism, same stuff.
This doesn't depend upon what the DNA. This is completely non-specific. It doesn't depend on anything on the sequence. Mm-hmm. This is just, that's why, for me, DNA is just a long chain at this level. Okay. I don't care at all about what the nucleic acid sequence is. There's another, not so much an experiment, but another kind of numerical result, because I was told I had to talk about polyelectrolytes as well. Polyelectrolytes are charged polymers like DNA, but if you take just flexible polymers that are highly charged, like DNA as an example, DNA has other properties of being relatively stiff. But let's say we take a flexible polyelectrolyte, like some polystyrene sulfonate or something, and then we don't have so many good experiments on this point, but numerical simulations, several kinds of simulations, show that if I plot somehow the dimension of this chain in water, I'm always talking about what happens in water, okay, that some kind of dimension of the chain, let's say the radius of gyration, I'll just call it R, as a function of temperature, okay, I'm taking a little bit of a liberty with the simulations, which is something that's non-monotonic. That at high temperatures it gets small, and at low temperatures it gets small. Something that has a peak in it. And this part was fairly well understood. This part here was kind of anomalous, okay. And the fact that it gets small seems to be that it's attracting itself. It's squishing itself in. Okay, so all these kinds of things seem to indicate that there are some kinds of attractions between highly charged objects. Mm-hmm. Now,
in this duration, is there a different dependence of, let's say, R or volume on N, the number of monomers?
It's a little bit more complicated, but you could take it. At least in this region, in all cases, it's proportional to N. It's linear. In some regions, then it changes. It changes out here and out here to smaller exponents.
And the characteristic temperature scale is consistent with the electrostatic energy, something like this?
Yeah, but I'll have to tell you about that. That's where I'm going, okay?
Yes, a large temperature why isn't the square root of N.
Yeah, it is down here, it's the square root of N. And down here, it's like N to the 1/3. And here, it's like square root of N. But in here, it's like... okay, now, so all of this kind of stuff is viewed as strange, but it shouldn't be viewed as strange. So I want to tell you how I think about these things. First thing we should remember is that, and in everything I'm going to be telling you about today, I'm only going to be talking about electrostatics, okay? There are other interactions, and we could arrange things. We don't have to worry about them, okay? So you have to take my word. Now, what we learn, at Berkeley when I took freshman E&M, and I remember the first thing, it was like the first day of class in the course from Art Kipp, was that the typical problem is that you're given a set of charges somewhere, you know, positive, negative, different signs, and you're asked to compute the electric field. You know, you just add up 1 over R. And then... that's after you learn about potentials, you do 1 over R. Then And then the next thing you're told is the thing that I know under the name of Earnshaw's theorem. And Earnshaw's theorem says that if you only have electrostatic interactions between point charges, you have no mechanical stability. The system is mechanically unstable. Okay, and classically, I mean, this is classical physics, and that implies that systems either. Charged systems either want to explode and fill the universe or collapse to a point. Okay. Now, in all the cases of physical interest, all the cases that we're interested in, that I've told you about, and anything that anybody is interested in, you're always interested in neutral systems. Okay. The electrostatic interaction is the strongest interaction we know about in condensed matter physics. And it rules, and therefore it doesn't allow charge separation, any appreciable charge separation. So therefore we're always talking about systems which are globally neutral. If a system is globally neutral, what Earnshaw's theorem tells you is pretty trivial, that everything wants to collapse to a point. So therefore, it's not surprising that electrostatic systems want to collapse. Okay. In fact, what's surprising is the reverse, that they don't want to collapse. Okay. Okay, and that, of course, at finite temperature, you have entropy, which is the other actor in this field. So the fact that things collapse to a point is not surprising, or want to collapse. The question is how does this work? How does this stuff manifest itself in these kinds of problems? Now, so to do that, I think the underlying physics is pretty simple. It's just as simple as what I said, and it's all built into the bi-Hückel theory. So what I want to do is unfortunately take a few minutes and remind you the bi-Hückel theory, and unfortunately, again, it's a sociological issue. The thing that we all tend to remember about the bi-Hückel theory, I've now learned, is not the right thing. It's not that it's wrong, but it's not the important thing. So what the bi-Hückel theory is the following. It's a little bit this problem. I have a set of charges, and the electric field is given by Maxwell's equations. Unfortunately, I'm old, so I refuse to use MKS units, I use CGS units. I'm sorry. though I have no epsilon zero, so you guys have to translate. So, and then the usual problem in freshman E&M is you're given a charge density and you calculate this. I mean, if you you can write it as a, do it as a, in terms of an electrostatic potential. Like that. I'm always keeping an epsilon, as we'll see, because I'm always working in water, and water has a dielectric constant of about 100 between friends. It's 80 at any temperature we care to choose. Now, the problem is that in any... I want to use the bi-Hückel theory for what it was originally used for. A 1-1 salt, sodium chloride and water. So I'm doing sodium chloride and water. Now the question, the problem is that this is a problem in physical chemistry. It's not a freshman electric E&M problem. So we're not told where the charges will go. So how do we know where the charges go in our glass of water? The salty water. So what the simplest thing to do, what physicists always do, the first thing to do is use mean field theory. So that what they say, therefore, is that the average density, or the density at the point in space R, is somehow proportional to the Boltzmann factor. T always is measured in Boltzmann, in units of Boltzmann's constant, at whatever the potential is at the site. That's the simple mean field theory. It's just a standard mean field approximation. the guy, some charge, feels the average potential due to all the other charges. It's approximation. It does what all mean feel theory does. It neglects fluctuations and correlations, and that's where we and that's where all the physics is. If we just insert this in here and keep on with our mean field theory, and now there's going to be a problem of semantics, another problem, we could write down this equation here for a salt is some constant times a hyperbolic sign of I'll use this as some, define this as some dimensionless potential. Okay. So this is a very highly nonlinear second order differential equation, which has a name. It's called the Boltzmann-Poisson equation. It's Poisson's equation with his Boltzmann statistics built in. And when you see a nonlinear equation like that, well, first thing, for our salt solution, our infinite bucket of salty water, the solution to this equation is trivial and obvious. It's phi equals zero. Because there's positive and negative charges homogeneously distributed, roughly speaking, everywhere. And that's, of course, the solution, but it's not very interesting. Okay. So we have to do a little bit better than that. So this is a case where mean field theory tells you basically nothing. Okay. Now, of course, when you have this horrible nonlinear equation, the first thing you do without thinking is you linearize. Worry about where you can linearize. And the linearized version of this equation looks like this, where kappa is you just follow the constants that I put in there. Kappa is the inverse to by screening length, and it's something like, I don't know, some number of pi's. N is the number of salt ions per unit volume, the concentration, and then times another length, which I call L. L is called the Bjerrum length. It's E squared over epsilon T, and it's about 6 angstroms for water. Okay, this is the fundamental length of all electrochemistry. And this is the Debye screening length, and that's just that's all built into this mean field theory. Okay. Now, if you're, for example, you say that I have a positive ion, a sodium ion at the origin, and ask for the electrostatic potential, such that there's that I put on as a boundary condition that there's a positive charge at the origin, that gives our famous Yukawa interaction. I mean, it's just that, okay? So that's the thing we all tend to remember. But that's not what I want you to remember. The thing that I want to tell you about is the free energy of this glass of water. I mean, I think everybody has learned this. I'm not telling you anything new. This is from the last century. But this is where all the physics is. If I ask for the free energy per unit volume in units of KT, I'm always sitting at some temperature. There's entropy and there's enthalpy. The entropy is basically the entropy of mixing of the sodium and the chlorines. So it has a term 2n log n, right? That's the entropy of an ideal gas of the two, because there's two signs of two ions. The next term is the electrostatic energy. But the electrostatic energy in mean field is what? Zero. Because for every positive interaction, there's a positive-negative interaction. And everything, the charges are homogeneously distributed, so there's no electrostatic energy. So that's all there is, and that's why in mean field, the ions, sodium dissolves, and the ions all go to fill the container. Now, of course, we have to worry about fluctuations. So what about fluctuations? There's no mean field energy. What about the fluctuations? So we look at Gaussian fluctuations around the mean field. So this you could guess the answer. Okay, you don't have to work it out. I mean, you could work it out, but you don't have to. First thing, the energy scale, it has to be negative. Fluctuations always lower the free energy. Now, we all learned that, so it's a minus sign. Second thing, the thermal fluctuations, the energy scale is KT. It's already taken that out. This is the free energy per unit volume, so I need a volume. The only length in the problem, when I've linearized, is the device screening length, so this has to be of the form minus kappa cubed. Okay, and you can work it out and find that. And if you work it out, you find out there's a 1 over 12 pi. Okay? That's the answer. Okay? So that's the first fluctuation correction to the mean field. So, and when you say the Debye-Hückel theory, there's some ambiguity whether you mean this or whether you mean this Yukawa thing. Okay? Okay? So, that's a question of semantics. I won't bother you with that. Different people do mean different things. Okay, but so this is the free energy in some approximation, of course. I mean, I've linearized and I've done things like that. You could look at this. Notice that this term here is proportional to the concentration to the 3/2 power. Okay, the way you should think of this is like a virial expansion. No, for an imperfect gas, except that because of the long-range Coulomb interactions, something strange has happened, and the thing that usually goes as n squared goes as n to the 3/2. Okay? That's the way you should think about it. But, okay, so this is kind of a virial theory. Now, the other thing you notice that these two terms are antagonistic. This, because of the minus sign, this term maximizes or minimizes the free energy with large concentrations. This one minimizes it for small concentrations, like the things to expand. So these two guys are going against one another. And in fact, the compressibility diverges. That is, these two terms cancel each other at some concentration, which is of the order of 1 over this L cubed. L is this Bierhm length. I mean, you just take the second derivative of this and set it equal to 0. So that's where the compressibility diverges, where you expect to have a phase transition. Of course, this condition is precisely the condition that the linearization, which I did here, breaks down. However, that doesn't mean that it's not right. It just means that you don't believe the numbers very, very well. Now, this, by the way, this concentration is of the order of 1 molar. And, of course, it's well known that you put in concentrated salts of a few molar, there's a phase transition to something that's complicated. And Michael Fisher and Marcia and his group have studied that problem, what the nature of that phase transition is, for 10 years or so. I don't know much about it, and this doesn't give you exactly the right answer, and the people who do the experiments are arguing with each other and killing each other what the nature of the transition, what the critical exponents are. I don't care about that. All I care about is that there is a transition, and you know what it's to. It's some collapsed state of sodium chloride molecules which are aggregating together and forming a crystal or something like that. So what I'm trying to do is to tell you here what the origin of these attractive interactions is. Now you see it. Okay, it's a fluctuation effect on Debye-Hückel. Now, unfortunately, the kind of problems that we're interested in are not just salt solutions. We're interested in more macroscopically charged objects. So how do we continue? Now there's a problem of geometry, and there's a lot of different geometries one could think about. The easiest thing to talk about now is flat sheets, because it easily illustrates the underlying physics. So let's imagine that I have a flat sheet. that, and let me for the moment assume that it's uniformly charged. Later on, I'm not going to be able to do that. So it's uniformly charged, and just for the sake of argument, let's take a negative. It could be a membrane, or it could be, I think of it as a membrane. Now, and again, it's always in contact with water. Now, because I always need that Biram length of 6 angstroms. If I had no neutralizing counter ions, see, the neutralizing counter ions are out here in La Flotte, as the French would say. If I had no neutralizing counter ions, then I just have a charged surface, and that's an electrostatic problem that I could solve. So if I have no counter ions, that's the potential as a function of that distance is linear, right? Because the electric field is constant. From Gauss's theorem. And therefore, when I start putting counter ions, they're going to fall right down here to the bottom of this infinitely deep potential well. That means they get stuck onto the surface, so to speak, with some thermal fluctuations around that, because I'm always at room temperature. And as I start keep adding counter ions, of course, they're going to go to the surface, they're going to screen the charge. But they're going to screen the charge that's going to give a net charge, which still has its potential diverging, albeit with a lower slope. So that implies that all counter ions abound. So the first thing is, for an infinitely flat surface, there's no ionization. All the counter ions are bound. And in fact, because they're all bound, it's clear that this linearization here is not good. And for this one-dimensional geometry, you know, you're lucky in the last century, Guy and Chapman solved this problem in that the mean field, nonlinear mean field equation, the Boltzmann-Poisson equation, in that thing. And there's an exact solution, which I'll write down. The potential diverges as the logarithm of Z. It still diverges because all the counter ions abound, and and what I care about is the charge density falls off at something like 1 over L Z plus lambda squared. Ah, lambda. There's a new length in the problem. That's an important length. It's what we call the Guy-Chapman length, just defined as the sigma, which is the area per charge on the surface. The inverse of the charge density, only the length, the area per charge, divided by some number of pi's times L, times the Biram length. That appears everywhere. Okay, that's the result of solving that nonlinear equation. It takes you 5 minutes to do it. I mean, okay. Now, all of the counter ions on this flat surface are bound to within a distance lambda from the surface. And first, let's remember what I learned. The only thing I learned as a graduate student, that physics is numbers, so we have to put in numbers. How big is lambda? For very high, the highest charge densities that exist for charged surfaces like this, sigma is about 50 square angstroms. L, I already told you, and 2 pi, you know. So therefore, this is a length which is greater than about 1 angstrom. But it's about 1 angstrom for highly charged surfaces. That already tells you you've got to be very careful about the physics when you have that kind of a length. Now, for weakly charged surfaces, it gets bigger, and then it's okay. Okay. Now, so this is already this tells you to beware. Okay. So that's for one surface. If I have two surfaces, now let's go to two surfaces. So I put in two of these same surfaces separated by a distance h. So this is the exact mean field solution. Let's calculate the force between these two surfaces. The easiest way to do that is to calculate the stress on the midplane, because by thermodynamic equilibrium, I can calculate it wherever I want. On the midplane, by symmetry, the electric field is zero, right? two identical surfaces. Electric field is zero, therefore there is no electric stress. E squared over 8 pi is zero. So the only momentum that could be shared here is the momentum associated with these counter ions, which have a finite density. So therefore we know what the osmotic pressure between these two surfaces is with the force, and the language is called of Derriaghan, the disjoining pressure is just KT times the density at the midplane. KT, because it's an ideal gas. Ideal gas of counter ions, roughly speaking. First thing, this is positive. Therefore, there's a repulsive pressure. It's positive definite. And in fact, our friend Brunsma, proved apparently that for any surfaces independent of the shape, but two identical objects, this is always positive. You could prove that. You could prove that pretty generally. Under these assumptions, under this mean field theory. So the pressure in mean field theory for fixed charges, which I'm talking about, is always positive. Here there are no batteries attached. It's positive, and you can calculate it. I mean, there's two regimes, whether the distance is large or small compared to lambda, and I'll tell you what it is. If H is large compared to lambda, this is clearly that something that goes as 1 over H squared. Clearly it goes as 1 over Z squared. And for H less than lambda, it goes as 1 over H, but whatever it is, it's repulsive. Okay. First, this contradicts Earnshaw's theorem. So obviously I can't use bad words. This is clearly not very good. Since it contradicts Earnshaw's theorem. So this is a obvious case where mean field theory is just garbage. Okay. It's not quite garbage, because there's plenty of experiments of the Israel-Ashvili type surface forces which show that this results of these forces, you can measure these directly, actually are pretty good for simple charged surfaces. The first thing where I realized that this was not the whole story was I learned actually from Hock and Wennerström a long time ago. When it was 15 years ago now, 20 years ago, he did simulations. Maybe he wasn't the first, but he was the guy who taught me about it. Simulated this problem, where he put surfaces with charge and put in charges and just simulated it, the whole thing. And what he found was that this kind of result was good if the charge of density of the surface wasn't too high, was less than about 50 square angstroms, but that when the surface charge density was unphysically high, was very, very high, that is, lambda was less than an angstrom, he found attractive interactions. And furthermore, when he had multivalent counter ions, I only had monovalent, he also found attractive interactions. And I think most people in this community assume this was his simulations were wrong. In fact, I think they were right. But because they disagreed with this, they gave these strange attractions. And after that, people in this room, Stefan and Schellender, I don't know if Roland is here somewhere, spent a lot of time, many years, trying to understand this, to do this better than this mean field theory, and try to see what was going on. Now, I won't tell you what they did, but the physics of it is pretty easy to see in the following sense, that that instead of looking at it from this point of view, let's do what probably most of you from the quantum well or semiconductor community would have done at the beginning is think of the problem of the ground state. Think of t equals zero. What happens at t equals zero? And this was first done in this context, I'm ashamed to admit, 1996 by Rosina and Victor Bloomfield. In the context, they were interested in the DNA problem. And what they pointed out is not very astounding, but is the following. Let's take one of these surfaces and look down on it. So I have this uniformly negatively charged surface, and now I'm at 0 degrees. 0 degrees, by the way, means lambda goes to zero. So now it's not one angstrom, it's zero. All of the counter ions are sitting right on the surface. And the question that Bloomfield and Rosina asked is, where do they go? Well, it's pretty obvious where they go. They form a Wigner crystal, a 2D Wigner crystal. So they form some kind of Wigner crystal. I don't know what it is, some kind of hexagonal lattice or triangular lattice. I don't care what. So they form a Wigner crystal. Now, already, once you have a Wigner crystal, you could ask, this is really easy. This is just like freshman E&M. What is the field outside of this? Because it's zero degrees. There's no temperature to make our life complicated. And, of course, if you get far away from this, it's neutral. So the electric field asymptotically zero. But close by, there is an electric field because there's a separation of charge. And it's pretty easy to calculate that the electric field falls off as e to the minus the distance over a length. And the length is the distance between these charges. What else could it be? Square root of sigma. Okay. So you have, now, once you have this electric field, if you have two such surfaces, of course you know what's going to happen. If the two such surfaces that face one another, the positive guys on the other thing will adjust so that they are at the interstices here, and that's the best way you could do it. They'll get their phases just right, and you'll have an attractive interaction. So therefore, at 0 degrees, you have, if I apply the potential per unit area or something like that, you have a very short range attractive interaction. It's very short range because it's exponential. And now you could imagine what happens as I, okay, that's good for Earnshaw. I mean, we like that.
What did you say about Earnshaw? I thought you said that Earnshaw proved that it's unstable so that it could go either way.
Yeah, but it could go either way, but the way it goes is to collapse when it's
so
neutral.
That's an Earnshaw plus your theory.
Plus neutral. Plus neutrality. Okay. So as you heat this up, of course, then you'll start to ionize some of these things, and presumably you get something that looks like that. At temperature greater than zero, but at 0 degrees you have this very short range exponential force. Now, how does that sit with this, which is the high temperature limit, if you like, of the same problem? Now, these repulsive forces, which were purely mean field, and I already told you from Debye-Huckel that you need to add fluctuations from in the high temperature limit to get attractions. So you could say, let's add these fluctuation attractions. Now, that's a hard problem, because if you take this exact solution and try to do the first Gaussian fluctuations around it, and a lot of people in this room have tried it. We tried it about 15 years ago. It's just mathematically hard. You basically have to solve an eigenvalue problem, which is like a Schrödinger equation with a position-dependent mass. It's very ugly. So you don't want to do that. So you can do various variational things. But at this level, I could just do the simplest thing. I could just say, okay, I don't care that the density is varying in space. I just treat it like ordinary Debye-Huckel. So I just put in a fluctuation term that goes as kappa cubed. Kappa is related to the density, n, and I just put in n of x. I mean, it's not quite right, but it's not so bad. And that gives you a term, a minus term here that goes as 1 over h cubed, and a term here that goes as 1 over h to the 3 halves. Just putting in by hand, and you could do that in your head while I'm if you don't believe me when I'm talking. The point of this is you see something immediately. First, at large distances, the repulsion always wins. And I was careful to draw it that way. By the way, which is what Bennerstrom also found. At small distances, however, this term could be bigger than that. The fluctuation term could win. And that's kind of really what's going on. And a lot of effort is trying to do these things better, okay, and finding where the crossover occurs. However, how much time do I have?
Another 15 minutes.
Okay. A couple of issues arise that you might ask. I mean, if you're a purist, not getting the numbers right, I'm not that much of a purist, but the issue is a little bit the following. How come, I mean, so we see where the physics is. The physics is really that these charges that are stuck on the surface are correlating with one another. That's really what's going on, okay? And that's really, these guys really identified the physics. However, why is it that at zero temperature, this stuff falls exponentially, is exponentially small, while there are attractive pieces at high temperature, which are power laws? And I never worried about that problem, but Dov Levine, who was visiting last year, did. And then we realized that there was something slightly missing here. And Andy Lau, sitting here, did all this work. And the thing you realize is the following. That what's left out here, of course, this is a T equals zero picture, and this is a classical T equals zero, is quantum mechanics. So there are quantum fluctuations of two types. For this two-dimensional Wigner crystal, there are phonons, where omega goes as the velocity of sound times the wave vector, and that gives rise, and these quantum fluctuations gives rise to the analog of quantum van der Waals effects. There's plasmons. Plasmons are interesting in two dimensions, because in two dimensions, they don't have a finite gap. All you quantum well guys know this. I didn't know it at the time. Goes as the square root of Q. Okay. Both of these kinds of fluctuations, the plasmons and the phonons, give rise to, of course, attractive zero-point, Casimir-like, I don't know the right word, interactions. This one is particularly noteworthy because it gives an unusual long-range interaction that falls off as 1 over h, I think, to the 7 halves, instead of 1 over h to the 4th, as it is in the phonons. These are things that are proportional to h bar. Okay, so these are quantum things, but they give power laws, so they solve this question. So this kind of exponential thing isn't quite right, because it's only right up until that distance, square root of sigma, and then beyond that, there's a power law attraction. Okay.
Can I ask you something?
Yeah.
I thought the original experiments you alluded to as motivation are at room temperature.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So this is not something. You're right. So this is not something. You're right. It's not relevant. You're right. You're absolutely right. It's not relevant. But it's only relevant in the sense that I wanted to understand the physics.
Okay.
So it's not relevant to any experiment.
But wouldn't you just use the word correlation physics? Describe that?
That's right. So the question that I have for you guys, the quantum Hall guys, you guys are worried about double quantum wells. Can you measure this force?
Yes.
Okay. And if so, how?
Drag. We have many talks.
Okay. So and you see this term, this 1 over 8, 7 halves.
No.
Well,
it's different.
It's a bit indeed.
Okay. 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 Okay.
Okay.
So the... thanks. Now we understand planes. Okay, so now from now on, it's kind of downhill. except for the polymers, is a little different. Okay, why is it downhill? So now we're not really sometimes we're interested in planes, because we're interested in membranes. But the planes have this one pathology which makes everything I said easy, and that's that all of the counter ions are bound. There is no ionization. For any finite size object, you put it in water, it will ionize at any finite temperature. If I put it into an infinite volume, entropy always wins. Okay, so finite size objects always ionize. So this flat sheet where no ionization is kind of we're treading on thin ice. Now, what else? What other kind of objects are we interested in? The people who are interested in DNA are interested in cylinders, because DNA is a little bit like a charged cylinder. And then what happens in that case? Now, everything that I told you happens more or less. There's a slight difference. If the cylinders are infinite, then they partially ionize. There's something that's called Manning condensation, and it's just, again, baby electrostatics, which plus thermodynamics, which tells you what the conditions to ionize. Basically, they ionize up to the point where the distance between charges A is less than the Biram length, this famous length that I erased, and that's the highest charge density you could have. In other words, if the charge density is lower than that, it ionizes, and then if it's higher than that, then counter ions come on and stick to it. If it's finite, it just ionizes. For this case,
actually, it's the other way around. You want to lower it?
Yeah. Okay. I always forget. That's the case called, sort of for DNA condensation, and the important contribution here, I think, the main important contribution was by Niels here, together, who was working with Bill and Robin is not here, Robin Brusma, and they actually calculated the interaction between two infinite charged things, which they use numbers for DNA. And if they plot something like, I don't know, the potential or the force, I'm only sketching it so it doesn't make any difference, what they find is something that looks like this. This is a kind of attractive interaction. When they put in for the charge density numbers for DNA, and it's something that looks like this is all at room temperature, at finite temperature, and this is what they find if the charge density, let's say, is half that of DNA. These are, by the way, with divalent counter ions. Okay? And the physics of this is exactly the same as what I told you for flat sheets. This attraction comes because at for highly charged rods, this is a higher charge density here, you have these counter ions are somehow correlated in some kind of quasi one-dimensional-ish Wigner crystal, and these guys correlate, okay, roughly speaking. So this is anomalous. Highly charged rods attract, weakly charged rods repel. By the way, it's the same for surfaces. Weakly charged surfaces repel, strongly charged surfaces attract. Okay, it's exactly the same phenomenology. It's more complicated to work out, the geometry is tougher, and you have ionization. If I go to the case of spheres, charged spheres, which is the original one I told you about, again, the situation is the same. Here we have some preliminary simulations by Niels, which does show attractive interactions, certainly for divalent counter ions at room temperature and high charge density. It's the same kind of thing. But we don't, I wouldn't say we don't completely understand analytically where is there a crossover? When does the force start becoming attractive or when does it start becoming repulsive? What are the criteria? And in some sense, that's a little bit of an embarrassment. I mean, because what I'm telling you is that if I take a glass of water filled with spherical charged particles, and I color two of them, and I ask some smart guy like Dave here what the force is between them, not even what his number, is it repulsive or attractive, he can't tell me. Or maybe he can, but I can't tell you. I can't tell you. And I think this is embarrassing. Why are we working on esoteric things like strings? We don't understand the force between two charged spheres. I don't understand. And we really don't understand it very well. I mean, I think we understand the ingredients now, but we don't understand in the detail very well. Now, what about, should I say anything about polymers or not? No, I think I don't want to say anything about polymers. I mean, I could, but it's more of the same. So I don't want to. You've had enough.
Before you leave the rods, right, where do those special molecules?
Well, they're divalent. They're multivalent. The fact that they have high charge. Okay.
What are they doing? That's
yeah. Okay. So let me. Okay. Good thing. Good question. Let me go back to the plane. When I told you about the plane and this famous GUI Chapman length, I did it for monovalent ions. If I did it for ions which had a valent Z, then the only difference would be a Z here. Okay? So that means that the highly charged guys are even more strong. Well, it's obvious, they're even more strongly attracted. So the issue, what's going on here, is that when you have multivalent counter ions, they really get stuck on the surface. Then they could form some kind of very highly correlated array more easily than the lowly charged guys, and it's those correlation of those fluctuations which give rise to the attraction.
So they are stuck on the DNA.
They absolutely are stuck on the DNA in that sense. That's what I said. They form complexes.
I didn't know what a complex.
Oh, okay, stuck on. Okay, and it's all kind of simple now. And so it's this Z here that's very important. That's why multivalent ions behave, I mean, they look like they behave qualitatively different. They don't, they just behave quantitatively different than monovalent. It's just a device to charge up the electrostatic interactions. Yeah.
And at the same time, you're lowering the entropy because you have less ions necessary to...
Absolutely. Both things happen at once. You lower the entropy because you have less of them.
But you're not saying that you're not going to see any way with monovalent.
Pardon me?
If you have, for instance, there you see easily with plates, but then you come with cylinders, and then things get more difficult, but numerical difficulties.
I think it's just numerical difficulties, and I think in principle you do have it with monovalent. It's just that the numbers are such, the room temperature is such, that it doesn't quite work with monovalent. If we lived in a universe where room temperature was different, I mean, by the way, if you think about the relationship between these kinds of electrostatics and biology as we know it, you realize how delicate thing is. You know, that it very much depends on the Biram length being 6 angstroms. If it were 20 angstroms, life would be very different. It wouldn't exist. Okay. Any other questions? Okay, I can go ahead.